Not to put down white people.
White people.
I can write about white people. White people can write
white
about
people.
They made white people.
Well, I guess white people must have felt.
Dear white people.
We sure are hearing a lot about white people lately. From political news about white supremacy rearing its ugly head in places like Charlottesville to cultural discourse about who has privilege and where it comes from. But we don't have a lot of experience trying to really understand whiteness in America. Why is that? And could it be part of what's going on in our country right now? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And I'd like to start the conversation with Nell Irvin Painter. She's a historian, and her book, The History of White People, was published in 2010. Hi, Nell.
Hi.
What was it that made you want to look at white people really explicitly back in 2010? I feel like way back in 2010, the idea that white people were even something to look at, that was not a popular idea.
Yeah. All my books have started with questions, you know, why is something? And this one started with a question that came out of the Russian war on the Caucasus. And most Americans don't know where the Caucasus is or are. And certainly I didn't have a clear sense either. I looked it up and I thought, well, what does this have to do with white Americans? And that's how I started. That's how I started my book.
Can you connect the dots a little more? Why did you wonder what that had to do with white Americans, the Caucasus?
Well, the Caucasus is it's located in the borderland between Europe and Asia, between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. There are places in the world that are farther from the United States and North America, but this is pretty far, and it also, it's not something we think about. I mean, if the word had been, say, Japan, we would have had something to think about because most Americans have some ideas about Japan. But the Caucasus? Why are white people called Caucasian? So that's the question I started with, and it took me first to Germany in the late 18th century. So I just kept following the answers, which raised more questions and then more answers and more, and I got a book out of it.
So the central question of your book, it seems to me, is really how people have understood whiteness, right? More
yes.
than whiteness itself.
Well, there is no such thing as whiteness itself, just as there's no such thing as blackness itself. These are concepts. They're not sort of blocks of ice or something like that. So there have never been agreements on either what is whiteness, how do you define it, or what is blackness, or even what is race. If you say, well, what's the difference between race and ethnicity? Well, if you look one up, you'll get the other, and if you look the other up, you'll get the one. These are ideas, they're notions, and they change over time, and it depends on who's talking to whom, when, and where. So, for instance, we say, oh, yeah, yeah, we know what white people are. But there have always been sort of asterisks or questions. So, for instance, in the United States now, probably most Americans would think that Jewish people are white people. But that's not what we saw in Charlottesville. Those terrible people with their torches and their hateful signs, full of anti-Semitism. In the 20th century, were Syrians white? Did did people from Eastern Europe belong to whiteness? How many white races were there? So in the 19th and 20th centuries, educated people thought there was more than one white race. There were many white races, and some were better than others. So in the mid-19th century, when there was a very large migration of very poor people from Ireland, it went around an old idea, but an idea that became very popular in the United States and Britain, that people from Ireland, that is to say Catholic people from Ireland, poor people from Ireland, belonged to a white race, but it was an inferior white race called the Celtic. So in the United States in the 20th century, there was the idea, okay, maybe people who were Slav were white people, but they belonged to an inferior white race. So the idea that there was just one white race is situated in time, and it's the mid-20th century.
What was it about the mid-20th century that really put a kind of an exclamation point on a concept of whiteness? I mean, I think I know the answer to this, but I am not sure.
There are two big answers. One has to do with German Nazism.
That's the one I was kind of thinking of.
Yeah, so clearly racist and hateful. In the early 20th century, educated Americans and Germans shared a lot of the same ideas, which we now see as racist or white supremacist and odious. They were commonplace ideas, such as people from, say, Germany were Teutonic and were better than people from, say, Italy, and that Jews belonged to a race and were terrible people. Many Americans believed that. But when the Nazis came to power and they started killing people and throwing them out of schools and their professorships and doing things that politically that were clearly odious, then a lot of Americans began to re-examine their views and back away.
Is there something about a moment like that? I mean, a moment that shows you what an idea taken to an extreme looks like that makes you more... aware?
Yes, and that's what Charlottesville did. But the second thing about the middle of the 20th century is political, and it has to do with who's going to vote and mobilization, economic in the New Deal, and political in the Second World War. Before the New Deal and before the Second World War, Americans whom we consider white were fractured, and many felt they were not really appreciated in the United States, and they didn't vote, they were not active. But in those two moments of economic and political crisis, Franklin Roosevelt, for one, let's just call him the symbol of the politics of the time, realized that we have to have American unity. We have to include everybody. And when they, it was still within racial segregation, so when they included black Americans, it was still under segregation. But that was a time when they said, no, there's just one white race. There are three real races, and one is Caucasoid, and one is Mongoloid, and one is Negroid, in that order. And so that was the truth. Anthropologists delivered it. That was the truth, the educated truth that came out of the middle of the 20th century.
So people believed that there was like a science to that, or?
Of course. Yes. I mean, there was a science to the idea that Celts are an inferior race. The scientist, the anthropologist, the physical anthropologist went around measuring people's heads. And in my book, I have a big discussion about what was really important anthropological science in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, which was based on head shape.
Was there also an understanding? I mean, it sounds like there was an idea about sort of like almost like bloodlines or like, I don't know, biological races.
Oh, yes.
But
yes.
Is there also an idea about culture that goes along with different groups?
Yes. We would call it culture. The early 20th century term was temperament. So it was thought there were racial temperaments. And so, for instance, Southern Italians' racial temperament made them very cute and good singers and dancers. And the racial temperament of English people and Germans, Teutonics, they called them in racial terms, they were settled and they had a genius for self-government. So there were racial temperaments in that science. And I don't put an asterisk or quotations around the science of race that we no longer believe in, because the people I studied were people who were the cream of the intellectual cream in the United States. So I did not study white supremacy or white terrorism or Ku Klux Klan or anything like that. What I did was trace an intellectual history of notions of the meaning of the white race or white races in the United States. It took me out of the United States because some of those ideas are older than the United States. And then also, we often believe that the ideas that we have now can be traced back to a time when they simply did not exist. So I started my book in antiquity because many readers believe that the ancient Greeks and Romans thought about race in the way we do. But race had not been invented at that point.
What do you mean race had not been invented?
Race was invented during the Enlightenment of the 18th century. So, for instance, the ideas...
But like Romans and Greeks were pre-racial?
Well, yeah, you could say that. I mean, they could see that some people were light-skinned and some people were less. I mean, they had eyes in their heads. But the meaning that they made of those differences was not what we call race. Race is a scientific category, and science was invented in the 18th century.
You know, I want to get back. Sorry. I just want to get back to the idea of whiteness in particular, because something that you said when you were talking about that earlier caught my attention, just how old this idea of degrees of whiteness is. I mean, it's something that you hear now even just kind of in joking terms, like someone, a white person, might say to another white person, I have heard this, you're the whitest person I've ever met, something like that, you know? And it's just an odd idea.
Well, sometimes if you say, oh, you're the whitest person I've ever met, it meant that person was really, really pale with really, really pale eyes and really, really pale hair.
Which I don't think is really what it means now.
But do they mean in temperament and culture, the way they dress, the way they talk? Is that what it means?
I think it might, like what music you are and are not familiar with, that kind of stuff. I think so.
Yeah. Well, to decide who decides, you know, that's a big deal. So, for instance, if your friends are saying, oh, it's the way you talk, and it may be somebody from Massachusetts or California, would it be somebody from Alabama? That's a good question. But I said earlier, there's never been agreement on how you decide. There's never been agreement on the criteria. And so people use this term very loosely, and it changes by situation, by context, by time.
You know, so speaking of, I mean, today's political climate, we are in a very particular time. And I was listening to the mayor of Atlanta, who is an African-American man and a civil rights activist. He was talking on Meet the Press, and he really surprised me by saying that he was a little reluctant to denounce white supremacist groups and neo-Nazis only because he felt that they were, in his words, the poorest of the poor, that they were being used, and that there's a real danger in sometimes talking about race when we're really meaning class and vice versa. Is that a long-time source of, I don't know, frustration, confusion, inability to sort out one, unfortunately, one power struggle from another?
Well, many power struggles from many others. I thought you were going to say he didn't denounce them because they were his constituents.
Well, and that's another thing that's probably hard
that's
to tease
another
out.
Thing. But the whole question of why do poor white people or working class white people identify with elite white people whose policies are not in their interest, that is an old one. At least into the 19th century. And the answer usually is, well, it's psychological. It's a gut level thing, that it feels better to them to identify with rich people than to identify with black people, who symbolize downtroddenness. But I think there are probably many answers to that, and the people who can answer the question are those people themselves.
Have you been surprised by the direction that the conversation about whiteness has taken since the publication of your book, The History of White People, in 2010?
Yes. Particularly, the most recent surprise has been since Charlottesville. I was pleasantly surprised that so many non-black Americans denounced the president's equivocation and denounced the white supremacist and denounced the anti-Semitism. So that came as a surprise, and it was a good surprise. As far as the older, so 2010 is getting to be a while ago, but when I first started working on that, it was like 2000, 2001, and people would say to me, oh, are you writing it as a black person? Meaning, are you writing it to settle scores? Are you going to get back at white people? And I would say, no, I'm writing it as a historian. It's like, oh, if you're black, you can't also be a historian. And people would ask me that for the first few years. There was a lot of anxiety I would encounter. And then around 2005, around in there, it let up. You know, I was getting ready to say, no, I'm writing it as a white man. But I didn't have to use that line because the hostility settled down. And I heard, oh, what are you finding? Oh, I want to read that. How interesting. I mean, people had no idea mostly, you know, what could that be? Because at that point still, whiteness was a pretty obscure concept. One thing that has changed since I wrote, and the 2016 presidential campaign and the Trump administration have helped this change. When I wrote, I could say that probably most white Americans didn't feel themselves as white.
What did they feel themselves as?
People, individuals.
Just people.
Yeah.
No need to delineate.
They didn't have a racial identity. That was for people of color. And everything that went with that was on the other side of the color line. That is no longer the case. And after all this upheaval, I think millions of white people are saying, well, hey, what does this mean?
Well, it's time for a break. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, you can join the conversation. How do we talk about white people? Has it changed? Does it worry you? Should we be doing it better? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back with a little added focus on recent news. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I've been talking to Nell Irvin Painter, who wrote The History of White People. Hi again, Nell.
Hello.
Now let's talk politics, as in today. We're joined by a KU political science professor, Don Heider-Markle. He's an expert in identity politics and extremism. Hi, Don.
Hello.
We're also joined by Frank Morris. He's a reporter and senior editor here at KCUR, and he's been reporting on some of these political movements, both locally and nationally. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Gina.
So, Don, I'm going to start with you. This conversation about whiteness has been sparked, obviously, by Charlottesville. What do you see as the relationship between political views expressed in Charlottesville and whiteness?
Well, there's been an observed pattern over about the last 10 years where increasingly, at least in the kinds of public opinion research I look at, that increasingly you see people identify as white in surveys and identify as American. You also tend to
What do you mean identify as American?
So when people ask them basic questions about, allow them to write in responses to questions, increasingly you'll see people write in American for where are you, who are you, what race are you? People will actually write that in.
So American as a race.
Right. And you also see a pretty significant increase since since Obama was elected president in the percentage of white people indicating that in a standard group of questions, does this particular group receive discrimination in the society or not? Including white people as a category there, the percentage saying white people are discriminated against has gone up from the single digits well over 30% over the last 10 years.
What do you think that's about?
Well, I think it is I don't think 2016 all of a sudden created this white identity idea, but increasingly there's just been an increased consciousness about identifying as white and trying to, in some sense, define what that is. And I think a lot of that is, in fact, in reaction to the first African-American president.
What is there a way to identify as white and have some I don't know. It seems like identifying as white has two camps to it. There's an identifying as white and owning your privilege, that kind of talk about around it. And then there's an identifying as white that's sort of, more in that white supremacist kind of camp, kind of like associating, superiority with it. Is there any other way to identify as white? Is that strictly a power designation? Because it seems like both groups kind of see it that way.
Well, because what we call sort of what people call as white or Caucasian is the majority in American society, it's hard not to, if you identify that way and really want to take that as saying that's important to who you are, I think it's hard to get away from the notion that you're not talking about a superiority or even moving down the lines of, as Professor outlined, for purity ideas or some kind of ranking system. For various social identity groups, including race, part of what groups do or tend to do is not only designate sort of who belongs and who doesn't, but also develop narratives or worldviews about the relative position of that group in society that group members or those who closely identify with the group tend to adopt. So if we identify closely as white people, then we see we're the majority group, hold positions of power, dominate resources, et cetera. Well, if that's the case, we must deserve to be in that position. We must be superior than other groups in some way. That's the kind of logic that flows, and it's not that other groups are protected from that way of viewing things. But when you're in the majority, you tend to explain your position in a positive light.
I think there's a third way of looking at that too, though. I mean, when you say own your, some people own their privilege, and other people assert dominance. I've talked to a lot of people who, If you're a truck driver, if you're like a 37-year-old truck driver, living in a trailer and not able to pay your bills, you're not feeling a lot of white privilege. If you're an upper, middle class, white person living in camp, well, that's maybe a different story. But there are a lot of people who feel like they've been under assault from people defining them as, a privileged, and they feel like the just being white is kind of like makes them an open target. As folks I talk with, in the alt-right, a lot of them will say that it's not a matter of, they will say it's not a matter of asserting dominance. It's a matter of sort of having a racial tribalism like a lot of other races, they see a lot of other races having, and sort of circling the wagons because they feel like it's sort of open season on white people.
Can you tell me more about how you are hearing some of what we're saying in the context of having talked to a lot of people who are part of the kinds of movements that are inspiring this conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, the sense of identity, that maybe didn't used to exist, that's kind of come along. I mean, that what I hear people saying is just what I've already said, basically, that it's more of a preservation. They're trying to preserve maybe status, but also just a sense of that they're real people too, and that when people will sort of paint with a broad brush about any group of people, some people are going to take exception, and a lot of these few people feel like they've been unjustly attacked.
Let's bring Joe in on this conversation, because I have a feeling that he'll have something to add to where this is going. Let's talk to Joe in Overland Park. Hi, Joe.
Hello. You talked about how race was an invention, and I was wondering if this whole discussion of whiteness or blackness really just does more to perpetuate the problem than solve it, because you go back generations and you get any things of compensating for what fathers did or such, and treating people as groups or names versus just trying to do the right thing on a person-to-person, day-to-day basis, and just accounting for it like that.
Nell, I want to bring you in to address mm-hmm. that first. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are your thoughts about...
Well, I think treating people on doing the right thing on a person-to-person basis is a really important first step. And it may be sufficient for a vast majorities of people in the United States. But for those who are seeking answers, then I have two suggestions. And one starts with just educating oneself. For people who are saying, geez, I don't know, there are libraries and librarians. There's a vast bibliography created since these questions came up in the 1960s and 70s. And anyone seeking answers can go to the library, speak to a librarian, and say, I want to know about, say, how concepts of whiteness appear in fine art. I want to know how concepts of whiteness appear in literature. I want to, whatever it is that you're interested in. The first step is education. The information is there. So there's no one answer for many people. Just being brotherly or sisterly will suffice. For others, going to the library will be important.
I kind of wonder if it sounded to me like Joe was asking whether even talking about that the act of talking about what whiteness is and what blackness is or things like that and how we understand those things mm-hmm. is maybe yeah. entrenching us in a view that we're separated.
That is his view, but clearly other people don't share it because they do want to talk about it. And for people who do want to talk about it, it's important. For those who don't want to talk about it, well, turn off the radio.
What are your thoughts about this, Don?
Well, I think it's, as a teacher and as an academic, it's always hard for me to say, well, we should just ignore it and it'll go away as a solution to something. But clearly it's also the fact that we understand, whether you want to call it tribalism or something else, that people develop individual identities that involve their group status. And how those groups are defined, of course, is a complete social construction, but that doesn't make it not important or trivial.
That hasn't affected people's lives.
Right. So as long as that happens, from my perspective, it's not really so much important to say what should be, but here's what is, and how do I best understand it?
Yeah, and that's education.
Frank, for you, just as someone who mentioned the concept of circling the wagons and tribalism, do you hear something in the question as Joe is asking?
I do, but I guess I fall pretty squarely with Don on this. There is a discussion that's going on. There are thoughts that people are having, and you can't say that's a thought crime to put up racial dividing lines between people, because people are organizers and they organize in all kinds of ways. And So I think you got to have just, to the extent possible, just open conversations about this and expose the ways in which it doesn't make sense to have these kinds of categories, because just not saying we're not going to talk about it isn't going to help. It isn't going to move the ball forward.
Let's talk to Sabrina in Kansas City. Hi, Sabrina.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about the example. I'm not sure who gave it, but talking about the 37-year-old truck driver who's not feeling much white privilege and the person in Johnson County who is, because I feel like that person does not understand what white privilege is, because it has nothing to do with where you work. It's about your skin color and how people initially treat you as soon as they meet you. When I walk into certain stores in Kansas City as a Black woman, I immediately get followed around. And I'm pretty sure the 37-year-old truck driver isn't getting followed around, which, you know, also touches on the other point of, I think more people need to be educated on what they're fighting against before they start picking up torches and fighting against it when they don't even understand what the concept is and what we're really talking about in the first place.
It does make me wonder if there's kind of a language and communication problem, that people are not all using words the same way, or not all hearing words the same way, or understanding concepts in a shared way. What are your thoughts about that, Don?
I've always thought the term white privilege has been kind of unfortunate, because it gives people the sense that you're saying that every white person automatically has some kind of status above and beyond people who are non-white, and that white people don't have to struggle to get things out of life or be successful. And I think that that's always been unfortunate, because that's not really the implication there. It's that the experience is different for white people, and some things that are taken for granted, other groups can't take for granted in their daily lives. So it's always been an unfortunate terminology to me.
I have some thoughts about that, but I'm going to bring Nell back. Nell, what are your thoughts?
Yes. Well, I think on two levels. On one level, whatever terminology we might use for that concept that we're calling white privilege, a lot of white people aren't going to like it because of the content of what it conveys. Maybe because they are struggling economically. So, for instance, take the truck driver. You might say, well, okay, let's look at the median income and wealth of white truck drivers and non-white truck drivers. And you will see that non-white truck drivers are poorer than white truck drivers. You can see that any way you look at, say, economic statistics, white people are much richer than non-white people. White people are more educated, and so on and so on. We can go on and on and on. So objectively, clearly, this is still a country that white people run. That doesn't help the person who says, wait a minute, I don't have white privilege. And it's part of what's going to be perhaps a learning process, and maybe it won't be solved, because the investment in seeing one's white self as discriminated against and downtrodden is so high that no amount of data or education will help it. This is very possible.
I wonder if there's also a difference between the idea that you can say that whiteness comes with certain privileges without saying that there aren't other kinds of categories of things that gives some people privilege and others relatively less. I mean, this is a complex thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first hard thing is to realize that generally white people are better off than non-white people. I think if I said that to this putative truck driver, he would disagree with me. And no matter how much I showed numbers and statistics and wealth and, you know, all that sort of thing, it would not make a difference, because this is a gut-level thing. I mean, what makes race and racism and race thinking and feeling so hard is that it does operate largely on the gut level. It's like class in Britain.
in England, people feel class on the gut level, and they wonder why we get so agitated about race. And Americans look at English people and say, but it's only class. So I just said that I think education is really, really important, and I do believe that. But I don't believe everything is going to be fixed.
I think there's a class element to this, though, too. You know, I mean, it's not true that all white people are privileged equally. And
yeah,
people who are poor white people.
If you look at how much money, how much education, and how much wealth people have, yes, white people are doing better.
Right,
so
but that doesn't make any difference
class,
to.
But you need to look at class on both sides of the color line, or all three, or all five sides of the color line.
When your
class does not stop with white people.
Right, but disadvantaged white people are a group of people that are really easy to make fun of, and there's no social stigma. Or there's less social stigma for calling somebody white trash. And so you have a group of people that feel like that, again, that it's just open season on them. And I think that that's, I'm not saying that they're right, but I think that there's a pretty strong sense that when there's talk of white privilege, they're really, really talking about someone else other than somebody who is really struggling toward the bottom of the social and economic ladder.
I bring us back to that question that the mayor of Atlanta had asked about it being very hard in some cases to tease apart race and class. And that's in all kinds of conversations, all kinds of conversations we've had on this show. I think it's hard to tease apart race and class mm-hmm. when we're talking about a variety of subjects. Is that, Nell, something that is like across continents, across time?
No. It's about the categories that are important in our culture. And race is a very important category, as is gender. You know, these are the really hot-button issues. But interestingly enough, when we talk, here I'm thinking about the campaign in 2016 and early 2017, it was as though only white people have class. So it was, these working-class people are suffering. Well, wait a minute. There's some working-class people suffering who are not white. And so un-white people who are suffering or homeless or working class, they need to be part of the discussion of class in the United States. Absolutely.
Let's talk to Bob in Kansas City. Hi, Bob.
Hi. How are you today?
Good.
I just wanted to insert, you were talking about this at the start of the show about that you're the whitest person I ever met.
Yeah, that is a kind of way people talk.
Well, yeah, but there's an old expression that goes back, it's in some country songs even, that an expression that says, that's mighty white of you.
What does it mean?
Oh, it's not just country music. That was very popular in the early 20th century.
Right, right. It was very
popular.
I'm just saying that it's written down in country music. You can hear songs from the 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm. Bob, what does it mean in country music when that phrase is used?
Well, it goes down to the basis of what that black is bad and white is good, and that white is clean and honest. And that's mighty white of you, meaning you were always good to me. You were always straight with me. You know, this comes down to the very basis of what the race discussion is in this country, and we got my feeling is that this is not only a most important conversation, it's a necessity that for us to have, and that until people who are light skinned start talking about the fact that there is a privilege involved, just walking down the street, that the cops are more likely to, in a strange neighborhood, they're more likely to pull you to talk to you, ask you what you're doing if you're dark.
Bob, thank you. I'm so sorry to have to end it here, but thank you for sharing your thoughts with us, and we will not stop talking about this and related subjects. But Nell Irvin Painter, the author of The History of White People, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Don Heider Markle, thank you.
Thank you.
And Frank Morris, you've been great.
Hey, thanks.
Up next, a check-in on flood management here in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned.
I've never felt really comfortable in the kitchen. Next time on KCUR's Up to Date, writer Cindy Hodel treks to the big city from her home in the Flint Hills to teach me how to cook. Wish her luck, because she's going to need it. I'm Steve Kraske. Join us.
Join us for Up to Date coming up at 11 right here on KCUR 89.3, a service of the University of Missouri, Kansas City.
This has been a crazy year for flooding in Kansas City, and news from Houston has a lot of us wondering just how much water Kansas City can manage. Terry Leeds is Kansas City's water director, and he's here with us now on KCUR's Central Standard to talk about that. Hi, Terry.
Good morning.
So, as far as I understand it, part of what's going on in Houston, in addition to Mother Nature just wreaking absolute havoc to the tune of 9 trillion gallons of water in 2 days, is a development and design issue. The city's been built in a way that hasn't taken into account where water might go if there is a lot of it, which there is.
So that's a historic amount of rainwater they're getting in Houston. So I don't want to leave the impression by what I say that that is the bigger issue. The bigger issue is the amount of rain they're having.
Right.
But development does have an impact on how the water runs off of a property and through a community.
So the culprit in a lot of my reading on this, beyond the rain itself, of course, is pavement. That's what I'm hearing a lot about, is just pavement.
That's correct. We call it hard surface or impervious area. So when rain falls, in a more natural setting, nature has a way of taking care of it. It absorbs into the ground. The plants take it up. It's flat areas that pond up, and then they drain afterwards. Well, when development occurs, the hard surface, impervious area, roofs, driveways, streets, parking lots, buildings, that water hits that, and it's going to run off. All of it's going to run off. None of it's going to be absorbed into the ground.
So how do cities think about this, and do cities, and specifically Kansas City, do we think about this as specific developments are approved, et cetera?
So historically, civilization dealt with stormwater by getting it away from you as fast as you can. So you do whatever you could to get away from you.
That seems intuitively right on.
Correct.
Like, but you see it coming.
Right. But what we've learned is that's just moving the problem someplace else. So the bigger a metropolitan area grows, the more people that are impacted by that getting it away quicker. So over the last 20 years or so, the standards for stormwater runoff have changed. And now we recognize the need to kind of keep it where it falls as much as we can.
Why?
Well, if we keep it where it falls, one, it'll reduce the amount of water that's running off a property, less downstream issues. That is a quantity issue. It will also keep it from running or taking pollutants off of the property. So we have pollutants around us all the time, whether it's from your car or fertilizer or weed killers, trash. The water, what falls, it picks that up and carries it in the stream, causing water quality problems. So if we can hold that runoff on site, then it, and we're not going to hold all of it, but say the first inch and a half of rain, then that will reduce the quantity going offsite to reduce the problems of flooding downstream, and will also improve water quality.
So what keeps it on site?
So there's a number of different techniques. The first one that was developed was detention basins. So if you go to a shopping area that's been built in the last 10 or 15 years, you will generally see a basin. It's a dry basin. So all of the water from the hard surfaces are directed to that. It builds up in that basin and then drains out slowly over time.
So, I mean, is this something that people talk about, though, when is there like some citywide way of ensuring that individual developers are using these kinds of best practices?
So most cities have a planning and development area of the government, and they're the ones that make sure that the standards that have been adopted by the community are followed. So the city of Kansas City has a planning department, and they review plans to make sure that those are in compliance with the stormwater regulations that we're talking about.
Along with just a changing sense of what is smart, as far as like planning for massive quantities of water, has there been a change in practices?
Sure. So what we are using today that in the last 10 years have really come into more widespread acceptance is the use of green infrastructure. Green infrastructure is something that's constructed that treats stormwater more like nature would. So for us, at our headquarters building, we have redone our parking lot. That parking lot has pervious concrete. So instead of running off, the water goes through the concrete. We have pervious asphalt, does the same thing. And we also have put in paver systems, which are just blocks of manufactured concrete that have gaps between them. And the water, instead of sheeting off the entire parking lot, just runs across the block and into the crack and into a gravel bed below that stores that water where it can either evaporate out after the storm or it will drain off slowly into the natural system around it.
Has there been some like big picture kind of change in where and how water is diverted during heavy rains in Kansas City? I just ask this because it seems like I'm hearing anecdotally about a lot of people who hadn't previously encountered really serious flooding in their homes or businesses or neighborhoods before and are dealing with it this summer, whereas other people, I mean, I would put myself in this category. I've seen water in my basement for much more minor incidents than we've seen this summer. And my basement has been dry so far this year. And I just wonder if something has changed.
Well, I think there has been a change in weather patterns. The climatologists would tell us that we get more rain at a higher intensity than we used to get. And so we've had three of those in a metropolitan area since July 26th.
But I mean, has something changed in terms of the pattern of water flow and diversion in the city?
Not dramatically, because the city's developed over time, so that there's really no dramatic changes.
Talk to me about this summer in Kansas City. You were just talking about the three major incidents. I mean, how does this rank in terms of like seasons of flooding that you've encountered in your role?
So my role goes back to the 1990s. And for those folks that were here, there was what I call the Chiefs game flood, October 1998. It was a Sunday night game out at Arrowhead. They had to stop a game for 3 hours because of all the rainfall. That's the same storm that we lost 11 lives on Brush Creek. And so that's kind of the historical marker for me personally that I was close to and involved with. And since that time, we've had other events. But this summer, with three of them of that size, back to back to back, I've never experienced that.
You know, a city council announcement is expected today regarding a comprehensive plan to address flooding along the Indian Creek and Blue River Corridor. Can you talk to me a little bit about that specific place, like that issue?
So Indian Creek has been a chronic flooding area for years, and the councilman from that district held a press conference this morning that they will introduce a resolution that will basically support the city manager and working with city staff to develop more of a comprehensive plan on how we deal with that, not only necessarily within Kansas City, but maybe a more regional approach. The land is what it is, and so most of that water that comes through Indian Creek comes from Johnson County. So what happens in Johnson County does impact what happens in Kansas City. And we have a good working relationship with Johnson County Stormwater. We've worked together on Brush Creek issues. We've also worked with Unified Government on the Turkey Creek Basin. So we have some good background in how we work with other communities, and that's what we hope to do.
As a water guy, I mean, do you hear news out of Houston? Do you think differently from the rest of us?
Yes and no. I'm always amazed at the power of water. Water is our most precious resource, but it's also a very destructive and powerful force that we tend to forget about from day to day.
Well, our time is up, but Terry Lades, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Terry Leeds is the water director for Kansas City. You can listen back to both of our conversations from this morning's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. And you can join those conversations, even though the show is ending, on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Tomorrow, it's back to school season. Kids have their new classrooms, their new teachers, all the supplies have been bought. But now that everyone's settled into a new routine, people may be finding themselves stewing about what kids are eating in the cafeteria. The story of school lunch and why it isn't always healthier on KCUR's Central Standard. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Danielle Hogarty. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date is next. Don't miss it.